these would be described mostly in skeletons of theories. Now, and then I will focus on a stringy inspired model called the runaway digaton, which I worked on a few years ago. So that's the first part of my talk. It's quite general. I will cover some arguments that have already been covered yesterday by Victor and Maxime especially. And so let's start with the first part. So let's suppose that this guy here varies in time. Okay, so the most natural thing to do is in field theory at least is to think that this is in fact a field and what we are measuring is some vacuum expectation values or value of speed. This is what happens also in as we will see in string theories, where actually all couplings are vacuum expectation values of fields. So we promote this to a field. And what happens is that we can always normalize this field and make this alpha dependent on this field. So now, in order to see variation, I would say that we really need this the mass of the field to be very light, otherwise we would not see variation. So now I'm considering a situation where the mass of the field is extremely light, is let's say order up or less. Now, of course, Justin yesterday told us about a different mechanism, which is the chameleon mechanism, where actually the mass of the field can vary a lot according to the local value of the density of the matter. This is not what I'm going to focus on about here. So, for this field, there are... For this field, the following variation of alpha are expected in one hour time, let's say. So one is of fundamental origin, so it's really related to the derivative of alpha with respect to the field, and one is of cosmological origin. So now, for a canonically normalized field, this number. So if the field is a subdominant, this number is not very small usually. The optimistic view is that this field can be dominant at the same time. So for instance, if it plays the role of dark energy, this number can be order one. And then, and actually this number is this one, if the field plays the role of dark energy, where W is its emission state and and this is the quantity of non-relativistic matter. So so now we're going to see how the equivalence principle experiment constrains this quantity here. So since this number is order 1, if you expect variation of order 10 to the minus 5, you will expect variation of order 10 to the minus 5 on this derivative as well, let's say. So this is the typical crucial expected variation that that we may have. So let's say what equivalence principle variation says on this. And of course, what I want to show is that in fact the presence of this alpha depending on phi usually produces a dependence on phi of the masses of the components. So now these are not fundamental fields. This is just a very schematic way of putting into the Lagrangian some the values, for instance, so some atoms. So you should really think about this as a some elements. So you can expand this mass around some whatever its value, and this produces a vertex of this form. And as Maxime showed yesterday, this contributes to the gravity. So at linear order, you have the gravitational interaction two particles of this type, but you have also a star contribution to this force. So this star contribution is weighted by M prime with respect to the gravitational force, so that we can introduce an effective Newton constant, which will be generally dependent on the spaces. So for two different spaces, A and B, introduced this number C, which is usually called alpha in the literature, but since alpha we call already alpha the Fine Strasser constant, this will be C. So this is the log derivative of the mass of one species with respect to the field phi, and this is the effective Newton constant. Now, if all the species phi depended in the same way on phi, so all the C's are the same for all the elements, then you would have a metric theory of gravity, and only we will see this. So in general, we expect though that alpha variation, having an alpha varying will make different species depending in different way on phi for the reason that now, because when we try to estimate on fundamental grounds the mass of a baryon, so we have different contribution. So so the lightest contributions, which are not very relevant for what I'm going to talk about, are quarking electrons. For a very small atom, these are of the order of the magnitude of the mega electron volt, and have an electroweak origin because they are related to the Higgs mass. Now, I learned yesterday that in fact the contribution of the quark mass or the strange quark mass to the proton is a bit higher than this. It's over 20%.
Why wouldn't we do violation of the Coulomb's principle when it's the same solution?
Precisely, but it's not, and the same that it's not probably maybe is that thing. Now, the crucial part is the QED contribution to the variance, so to the mass of a variance. And this is, each nucleon will have a little bit of the, so the mass of each nucleon will have a little bit of dependence on alpha, but the dominant contribution comes from a collective bounding, column bounding. So the fact that you are forcing, through nuclear force, you're forcing all the nucleus to live together in the same nucleus. So this is really proportional to this number here, which where Z is the number of protons and N is the number of neutrons. So this answers probably a question that came out in the
rest. Why are you sure that this is dominant contribution? First, when we take just simple electron mass and check what is the renormalization term if we cut with the Planck mass, it would be 20% of the electron mass. So renormalization contribution in principle could compete with this contribution.
I see. I wasn't aware of this.
But also,
it depends where you formulate your effect.
Sure.
If you start at, say, GeV, that's okay.
There is also internuclear.
But still, it leaves it.
Internuclear. This is what basically
the chromatic direction. When you go down,
yeah, but this is, so this I'm saying, exactly. I'm saying that this is less dominant than this. This is more.
Like, can you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is really just a single contribution behind the body.
It's 20%, if you should 20% key, it's bigger than
so great. So, yeah. The alpha dependency is very clear, and of course, since this number varies for each species, you have that this log derivative is different for each species, and you have a composition dependent effects. Now, of course, the dominant part is a pure gauge part, which comes from a perturbative effect. So this is just a really more or less the sum of the nucleons, roughly, and this scale is set by the Lambda Qcd scale. So this is the part which is common to all the elements and is generally responsible for composition independent effects, so composition independent violations of the equivalence principle. Okay, so let's go back to these coefficient here and calculate them where I I'm not considering the dependence of quarks and electrons. So you have a most relevant part, which is the QCD part, which is the composition independent part, and then you have a correction of this type. Now, this is the derivative of alpha m over phi. This is a number of order m to the minus 1, and this is precisely the number that we saw before. So this is this E is this combination of the atomic numbers. So the most recent test, to my knowledge, of composition independent effects bound this number to be less than something like 3 × 10⁻². And this is made by Bertotti et al., the people, a collaborator based on the pulses from the Cassini satellite. So composition dependent effects are much well tested, and the latest is probably this one that says that the differential acceleration between two bodies like beryllium and titanium is bounded by this number. So this is the difference in acceleration to the common to a common object, which is the inherited in this case. Now comes the working type of hypothesis that you want to make. So if you suppose that basically the lambda QCD scale doesn't depend on phi in a relevant way, then from this result you would get this bound on the log derivative of alpha, basically. This is because these terms disappear, and you end up with so you write down this number, you calculate this number for beryllium, this number for the titanium, and you estimate this for the hair, which is the common attractor, and you would find out something like this derivative squared times 10⁻³. So you put it here, and you find this number. This is the approach of Odvari and Zaldariaga in 2001.
Just a question. Probably just measure difference between C hadronic and C electromagnetic. You don't need to put it zero. You just, by definition, you measure the difference. As I was saying, you see nothing. You see nothing. You know, okay.
Sorry.
You wrote that it's assumption that C hadronic is zero.
My
suggestion is you measure the difference. So.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm just saying if. So if this term is not dominant here, so like if I just use this this contribution to calculate that.
I understand. You need this term, right? So because on one end you have a violation of, so you have the phi exchange, right?
Yeah.
On one vertex you have non-composition dependent part.
Yeah.
On the other one, you perfectly. Happy to have a composition independent part, right? And that would be C hadronic.
Yeah, but you may.
Yeah, that's what usually. Is.
Yeah, but you may. So this is all referred. So let's say this is all referred to the frame to the. The Einstein frame. So let's say that I put all the dependence on the fields in. Okay. So there may be a situation where where the dependence where let's say.
Yeah, can I explain just one statement? So
yeah.
This constraint you get if you assume that C hadronic equals to zero. If you assume that C hadronic is in this formula is larger, then you get even stronger.
Yeah, precisely.
That's the state.
If I have the same, I get a zero. I understand what you're talking. But if everything depends in the same way, there is no violation.
I'm saying that your constraint is the product of two numbers. One is the same coupling for neutral and proton times some sort of a difference.
This is correct.
If the synchrotronic is larger than 0 by, say, 100, then you will have a much stronger bound on for sure.
This is correct, but if we are the same, result is zero. There is no equivalence principle violation.
So if this is zero, and this is zero, if we have from zero, for instance. Yeah, so if this number is equal for all species, yeah, but then,
If you study non-relativistic interaction, you should normalize C in such a way that the sum is zero. They should be in average zero. Average part you consider as a big G.
There is a phi exchange, right? Mostly the phi exchange, if synchrotronic plays any role, mostly the phi exchange is composition independent. But if there is a small correction.
But if you have only two material and nothing else in the world, the average of these two material is included into big G. So that means that when you study, you somehow study quadratic effects of the details.
But then you can see composition.
No, not correct.
It's what Victor means, so it's universal.
Everything depends in the same way, there is no effect.
No effect.
There are composition independent effects.
Yeah, because there are composition independent effect.
So if everything depends in the same way, this number is zero.
If you go to the first slide where you speak about big G. So big G from observational point of view, if certain average value. So that means that observational big G includes somehow average of CA, CB.
Yeah. But if this G depends on phi,
and you have a variation. You have many very different species.
Sure.
And what I'm trying to say that in the constraint on this electromagnetic part,
you always have an electromagnetic contribution.
You always have an electromagnetic contribution. So you're bound to have composition dependent effects, I think, if you explain variation of alpha with a field. I think we agree on this, right?
It varies exactly in the same way. You don't see anything.
No, you see composition independent effects.
I don't think I understand what we're talking about. Continue.
What about the rest of the audience?
So it varies in the same way. You have just this result. You have these results still. Because these are completely independent effects. This is the strongest equivalence principle.
This is a constraint from post-Newtonian.
This is
constraint on Brunstiger. Forget the Newton constants from 1/c² effects.
This is post-Newtonian. So
maybe we'll discuss it later.
Take care. Okay. The point is as mentioned yesterday that. If you suppose, and also in the last talk, for instance, if you suppose that there is a common gut scale where all the coupling match, then it's very natural to suppose that if alpha has some finite band, then this would be taken also by lambda QCD. So if you just define lambda QCD as the pole. In the running of the strong coupling, you would find this again, as many of you have said already. So you will find this relation between C hadronic and the dependence of alpha on phi. This number is typically of order 30 or something more, and so that as Maxim was arguing. The bound becomes stronger. You have an order of magnitude left. So you are really at the limit here already, so because this is you cannot have variation of the order of 10 to the minus 5 as z equal 1 if that number is much less than 10 to the minus 5, because then it would be a field running in one upper time of more than one unity, or much more than one unity, and this is very natural.
Yeah, you'll violate the constraints on W, right?
And then you violate the constraints. And in fact, you can see, again, in my first slide, this was very, very interesting, I think. that W close to minus 1 goes against, so it makes this number smaller. Okay, so let's see. So now let's go to the second part of my talk, okay, which is just a few words. Next year, hopefully, it will be launched a satellite for measuring this difference in acceleration of two bodies and some microscope and it will test the scale 10 to the minus 15, while the planned satellite step will go much deeper and test 10 to the minus 18. So this will be crucial, I think, for this type of research, and for this type of variations as well, I think. Okay, so now I talk about this extremely sparse scenario, because there are many atoms I worked on a few years ago. So, yeah, okay. The richness and the weakness of string theory is all the possible ways in which you can find something that resembles the world that we live. For instance, you start to think that you have many ways to go from 10 dimensions to 4, so you can compatibly use a brain model, etc. So I'm focusing now on the most basic model, which is just a compactification on a 6 dimensional torus of a torus string in this case, but it doesn't change much if you consider other type of strings. So you see that. This is naturally realized what we said before. So all the effective couplings in this three theory, in this theory, three level, are played by the vacuum expectation value of the reactor, which is a very nice occurrence because it's very unifying fashion. No? I don't have parameters at the beginning. All my parameters are just vacuum expectation values that some field takes. On the other hand, a theory of this type violates the equivalence principle bounds so really describes gravity in a way which is very different from what we experience. So, for instance, if you fix the value of the dilaton phi to be order minus 3, because you want this gauge coupling of being order of 0.1 or something, then you would be in a phi line, you would be more or less here, which is by definition of minus 3, and of course the conventional wisdom to fix the problem related to this strange type of gravity that come out from this action is to suppose that there is a potential of some non-perturbative origin that at some point fixes at the same point fixes the value of the dilaton where you want it to be fixed and gives the dilaton a mass such that you don't violate the current space for the problem with this picture is that you would need some non-perturbative effect, which is active in a perturbative region, because this is the weak coupling perturbative region. Now, what I want to talk about is a slightly different scenario, where there are reasons to believe that the effective action that you get from this, once you interact with the loops, etc., is very different from this. and actually makes the strong decoupling reason of the theory viable, so that you can really have a dilaton far up here and still have a nice phenomenology and a nice gravity almost equal to general relativity. So the idea came from Veneziano. He considered a field model in 2001, where just a field theory model with a cutoff lambda and a variety of fields. So the issue here is having a huge number of fields. So n is supposed to be very large. It is in fact a string theory where the rank of these fields are very high, etc. So you integrate over these fields, and you have that your capping renormalized in the following way. So the coefficient and the gauge capping get a major contribution, which is given by the cutoff, plus corrections, which are given by the bare capping, by the three-level capping at the beginning. Now, what is this telling us is that so if you apply this idea to the three-level theory that I showed you before, you would end up generically with a theory of this type. So now, even effective couplings are bound to depend on the dilaton through this function. So each term in the action has a dilaton dependence of this type. So if you play the same game and say, okay, so instead of the bare inverse coupling, I have the value of the dilaton, and I call the renormalized coupling through this function, then I will find out that my assumption, the physical assumption of the random dilaton model, is that all this function trivializes at infinity, so somehow have a dominant contribution order 10 to the order 100 discussed from all the string fields that I integrated out, and plus correction of all the ones plus the bare string coupling. Now, so since the crucial quantities are the derivatives of this guy with respect to phi, in order to have a phenomenologically safe scenario, the strong coupling is precisely the region where this action, strong bare coupling, is precisely the region where this action makes sense phenomenologically. It's a sort of a version of infinity of the more polyakov idea. So the more polyakov consider a generic theory like this and say, okay, if let's suppose that for some symmetry reason all these function at an extreme on some point phi, then two things will happen. First, the cosmological evolution will push the field towards that extreme, and the theory in that place, for that value of the field, is phenomenologically very safe. In this case, it is a bit less safe, and it is perhaps more interesting to consider, therefore, because, of course, the minimizing point is at infinity, which you cannot really quite reach. Just if you want, the value of the dilaton now is basically the value that the dilaton doesn't move during. But I give it to.
It'll read the table.
Right here. So this is the estimated value of the dilaton just after the inflationary period, and also now, because it doesn't move very much from inflation to now. And it's nicely related to, we just considered a inflationary problem. So chi is an inflaton, and n is the power of this lower order potential. And the value of phi now depends on the value of the fluctuation on last case. So this is to be 10 to the minus 5. And n is the number, is the power of the potential that you choose for your inflation. So now I'm going to give an estimate of the expected violations of the equivalence principle, keeping in mind, though, that these estimates are crucially related to the actual values of p. So these estimates will be considering that those all those b's of being of order one, so of being one, although you know that order one can vary from 4.1 to 10 or something. The estimates are the following. So the alpha hadron, the C hadronic responsible to responsible for independent effects, composition independent effects, is estimated of this order of magnitude, and it's fine with the actual limits and probably with the next future limits as well. What is nice is that in the, on the other hand, composition dependent effects, for instance, rule out already the n equal 4, which, and I remember it was the power of the runaway of this lower protection during inflation. So ruled out already this model, and are very very close to limit also the n equal 2 model. Independently of how the dilaton gets there, actually, there are estimates of this model which relate directly, independently and also independently of the actual value of the of those order one number b's b. There is a nice relation between variation of composition-dependent effects, but sorry, yeah, equivalent spacing variation here and the variation of the electroweak of the phi structure constant. Now this is only in the case. So if again, if the dilaton doesn't play any role, its velocity will be very small, and this number in front would be very small. Now, if the dilaton actually plays the role of quintessence, so it's responsible for the acceleration of the universe here, then you have this nice relation between these two things. So, interestingly, the level delta A over A equals to 10 to the minus 12 correspond to the level of accuracy that I'm learning is used by the clock experiments now, and although in this model it is very difficult to accommodate 10 to the minus 5 variation of z equal 1, because this variation is suppressed by a little bit more than 10 to the minus 5. Okay, I stop here. This is the main conclusion.
So, besides the background value from this scalar field, those are how fluctuations generated during the inflation.
Yeah.
Did you look at what sort of chaotic fluctuation of half would create?
Well, it was interesting because we hoped at the beginning that this may give a space like variation of alpha, no? Instead of everybody always talks about time variation, but you may give a space variation. They are negligible because, yeah, if you look at this case, I guess already, so intensity. Density you expect 10 to the minus 5, and then the actual fluctuation of the field will be even less or comparable. But then you have another 10 to the minus 5 from this derivative, from the derivative of alpha of the field. So.
When you ask a question, you see, the model of this relation now. I also have. Because we have not finished this discussion, just try to formulate the data. If all contributions are proportional, like electromagnetic, strong, and everything else, there is no equivalence principle violation.
Sure, but there will be constraints from post-Newtonian corrections.
So you mean it's completely different?
It's
relativistic. It's correction.
A zero to zero.
From relativistic correction, yeah. It's a different measurement. So
sure. No, but he used it.
Used it, okay.
Yeah, these are the evolutions of the strong
equivalence. You cannot have a kind of relative to gravity order one.
No, so you mean the
scalar
okay.
field.
Yeah, so it's a different thing. I mean, the scalar field produces different effects
from gravity.
For sure. It's a different effect. It's not equivalence principle. So.
But he,
it's
he
told
it was important.
Post-Newtonian
as well.
It's okay, relativistic corrections. Okay. Any other questions?
What's your equivalence principle? Universality of free flow and the curious principle is also the same.
Any other questions? So that's it. So you're only 10 minutes late, a little bit more, so it's congratulations. Thank you very much.